W here. Luckily, we've got WA2. RYY, checked in. This is the K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and we begin the check-in at this time. Sorry I'm a little bit late. As you guys know, so often I've told you that the main purpose of the TechNet is education. Curious radio amateurs gather at this time and teach each other what they've learned about wireless equipment. The TechNet is broken up into roughly three sections. The first section, people sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net. They give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes. Need that sign in just because you're listening by now. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. The second section of the TechNet is run by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, and he runs the science talk, and he's got some nice puzzles tonight also, and also the mailbag. Third section of the TechNet is run by Paul, WS2N, who gives us the space report, tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration and all the other space networks around the world, what they're doing. So at this time, we're going to take check-ins. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, if you do have a question or comment. K2RIW, TechNet Landmark, for listening. Everybody's still on their Thanksgiving holiday. Maybe they haven't come home yet. One more call. Anyone else that wants to check-in because they do have a question or comment? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW, listening.
WB2AHK.
Okay. And your name, sir?
Name is Chet. Yes.
Chet, J-E-T, Chet. How do you spell that? Is it C-H-E-T, Chet?
Short for Chester.
Very fine, Chester. Okay. One last call. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we're going to start off with Joe. Looks like we got lots of time tonight, Joe, so you can take your time. W-A-2-R-I-Y. K-2-R-I-W. Now you're a bit noisy, Joe.
Okay. I'll try this way. One way doesn't work. I heard myself through the system. It's pretty noisy. I guess you can copy this way, going from east to west. Okay, this question shouldn't be terribly hard. It shouldn't be terribly difficult for you to handle. Now you've handled much more difficult questions. Somebody that I just bought a car, fairly new car, that has this collision avoidance system in it. And the question is sort of like a RF question. This thing uses radar to tell how far it is away from a target in front of it. Here's the question. What happens when you have similar vehicles made by, like, say, the same manufacturer, similar models, that use the same kind of system riding on the roadway? Does the emission from one car bother another one, or do they all have a unique, exact radar frequency per car? Back to you, Dick.
I've got some guesses on this one, Joe, and maybe other people listening will correct my guesses. There's at least two ways of making a radar that's going to give you range to target information. Number one, you issue a brief pulse. You measure the amount of time required for the pulse to go out and come back. And the other type is the so-called sawtooth sweep. You can have a sweeping RF signal, a sawtooth sweep, and it looks at the difference in frequency between what's going out and what's coming back, which represents time. As a target is further away, it takes longer for the target to go out and come back, and therefore the swept signal, that's the echo, is a little bit different. The sweeping type of radar, you could have two of them sweeping to the exact same frequencies as long as they're not completely synchronized. There's very little time in which there is only a small difference. I mean, the signal going out and the signal coming back because of Doppler shift on the sweeping radar. They're probably only tens of kilohertz apart. And so the IF strip is looking for that tens of kilohertz signal in two separate cars with independent sweepers. The chances of them being synchronized and staying 10 kilohertz apart or 100 kilohertz apart is very unlikely. So they would essentially not fluke each other, is the word that they use in the radar world. Let me drop this.
I missed the key word that you just said because your audio is a lot louder coming out of the east repeater. I'm going to just switch to the west one to let reply to you because it's hard to copy your audio. It's like overbearing. So repeat that word you just said about radar.
Okay, let me take a look at the, listening to the eastern input. Yeah, my audio is quite a bit louder. Fruit, F-R-U-I-T. When one radar makes phony indications on the other radar, they call that fruiting, F-R-U-I-T-I-N-G. But, so, if it's the sweeping kind of radar, the chances of the two interfering with each other is very slight. If it's the pulse-emitting radar, where it measures very, it transmits very brief pulses, and looks for the echo coming back, the chances of two radars being on the exact same frequency is pretty slim. So the receiver is looking for something within, a small number of megacycles of the transmitter. So the chances of them interfering with each other is still fairly slim. So that's if they're using those kind of techniques. If they go the next step, where they're using direct sequence spread spectrum techniques, then each one can easily have an independent code. It can have a whole bunch of gold codes. So how it's done, I'm not sure. But there's such a large number of ways of making a radar. Anybody with good radar design techniques could find ways of getting a large number of vehicles on the road and essentially being transparent to each other, as I see it, Joe. When I listen to my... Oh, yeah, it is super loud coming out of the eastern input. Oh, well. W-H-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W with some further question. I mean, Joe, go ahead with some further question. K-2-R-I-W listening.
Okay, now, as brief it is with a radar pulse going out or by some other means sending a signal out, whether it's sweeping across frequency, very short time, and probably microseconds to maybe nanoseconds, depending on how far you want to look at a target. I was just thinking that something else emitting in the same band or close to it would cover up that reflected signal because it's got to be a lot weaker going back from the target once it hits the target to the back. That's where I thought the interference might occur or possibly have a chance of doing something funky to the radar it doesn't like. But okay, I guess you gave a good enough explanation. And the direct sequence... Well, spread spectrum sounds like probably the best way of doing it, if that's what they are indeed doing, because you could probably make a multitude of codes even within one manufacturer's equipment and end up with thousands and thousands of unique codes per cars or sets of cars and probably have a very, very small chance of one bothering another one. Back to you.
Chin KC-1SAM.
Hi, Sam. You probably know more about the collision avoidance radars on automobiles. How are they doing it? Is it swept frequency? Is it brief pulses? The brief pulses strikes me as a difficult way to go because you might want to be able to detect a target in front of you that's 5 feet away. Speed of light is a nanosecond per foot, so the echo going, the signal going out and coming back 5 feet would only be 10 nanoseconds delayed. And so that's an awful brief pulse. So I think they're more likely doing it as a swept CW FM type radar. If you want SAM, K2RIW, you got a SAM.
KC-1 SAM. If I had the answer, I would have made a comment. But my question is, why would they have radar coming out of the back of the car? So there's no chance of them interfering. There's no radar coming out of the back. The collision avoidance comes out of the front, doesn't it? That was my question about it. There's no reason to have it coming out of the rear of the car.
I don't think Joe was saying that the radar comes out of the rear of the car. He's envisioning two cars. Let's assume you've got a four-lane highway, two lanes going north and two lanes going south. Two cars are side by side, and there's automobiles in front of them. But the two cars side by side are both running collision avoidance radar.
And Joe, in that scenario that I just made, is worrying about whether or not they're going to interfere with each other. And there's various ways you can set up a radar so that the amount of interference between them could be kept pretty small. Swept CWFM type, I think, is quite likely the kind, because very similar to the way a, I was about to say the radar speed traps work that way. No, they don't. They're on the, for the steady state signal, looking for the echo Doppler shift because of the closing velocity. Could they do it that way? Now, I think it's most likely being done as a swept CWFM. The chances of them being synchronized, sweeping the exact same frequency range, the exact same rate, at the exact same time, is very slim. And the IF strip has got a fairly finite bandwidth. So unless, in other words, the echo coming back is very coherent to the radars doing the transmitting, and the adjacent radar in the adjacent automobile, there's only a very small chance that would give you any interference. Are you beginning to see that picture, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW, with some static.
Yeah, I understand what you just said, Dick, but I was thinking also more of you're going at a slower speed, and maybe you have cars at intersections waiting to make a turn, waiting to go through an intersection that are running the radar across you, not necessarily going the same way, and then also at a four-lane highway to one way to the other, you've also got people coming at you, and the signal from their radar would be a lot stronger than the echo you would get back unless the target's, like, very close to you. That's why I brought up the question, because there's a lot of possibilities of things that could probably happen that these engineers had to think about. I think you also one time said, because I think the subject was brought up in the past, possibly by me, that around that space.
Repeat your last sentence, Joe. You had a bit of a dropout.
I'm not sure which part you didn't get. Maybe something transferred on top beyond the other frequency. I asked the question because basically, like you said, on a two-lane highway, you got vehicles going two the same way and then two coming the other way. So I was thinking more of the vehicles coming at you that are putting out a strong signal that could mask your echo coming back at you, and also the possibility of you crossing a 90-degree intersection where you got vehicles on each side of you putting out a signal going across you as you pass by. That's why I was asking this kind of question. And I think you said it was sometime in the past that these radars operated something like 94 gig. Is that correct? Back to you.
Yeah, I've heard numbers like 74 gig and 94 gig in that kind of frequency region. I think the FCC has allocated some spectrum to be used by collision avoidance radars on automobiles. So you're right, a vehicle coming at you from the opposite lane is going to give you a pretty strong signal. But once again, it's not going to track the signal you're transmitting. And so, would the signal coming at you be strong enough to overload the front end? I think not. I think it's a mix of front end. I think it's got a fairly large dynamic range. So, if it is a swept CWFM type radar, you could operate an awful lot of those side by side. And as long as the sweeping is not synchronized, they would not interfere with each other. You'd only have to have a very slight offset in the sweeping frequency so that they would spend 99% of their time uncorrelated. Let's assume that your particular radar is sweeping from, 70 to 72 gigahertz, and it's doing it in millisecond rate, sweeping back and forth. And the chances, and it's looking for an echo that's only some number of kilohertz away from the transmitter, because the delay time, because you're not looking for targets that are a mile away, you're looking for targets that are feet and tens of feet away. And so the difference in frequency going out and what comes back is fairly small, so there's only some number of kilohertz of offset. And the IF strip is looking for that number of kilohertz of offset. The two radars side by side are spending, in my example, they might have an average of a gigahertz of separation, whereas the echo you're looking for has only kilohertz of separation for what's going out and coming back. And if the IF strip is only some number of kilohertz wide, it would ignore that other signal from another radar. So my guess is that's one of the ways they could be doing it, and I think they're pretty good at not interfering with each other, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the TechNet.
Q-H-U-Z with a question.
H-U-C, go right ahead. And is that Steve?
Yeah, Dick. Quick question. I heard you say a couple of times with the sweep method that it would have to be CW. Does it have to be CW, or would they be able to modulate something like the vehicle's VIN number so that they would be able to actually decipher the echoes coming back and then decide if the echo is relevant to the vehicle or not relevant to the vehicle?
A swept CWFM radar. You'd like to have it on all the time because the your signal-to-noise ratio is primarily a function of average power transmitted. So if you're only transmitting brief pulses, the CWFM radar would give you a much poorer signal-to-noise ratio. And if they are running CW, you're worried about the CW from car number one interfering with the CW from car number two. Because they are sweeping, in my example, I was sweeping from 70 to 72 gigahertz, sweeping 2 gigahertz in milliseconds with a sawtooth waveform. And maybe the sawtooth waveform is doing it 300 times per second, the sawtooth rate. The chances of two radars being synchronized and only kilohertz apart during many of those sweeps is very unlikely. So the way the independent sweeping is taking place, even though they're sweeping over the exact same frequency range, the two of them would spend, only when one swishes by the other one. I mean, one might be sweeping up while the other one is sweeping down. And they swish by each other for microseconds compared to the seconds of signal you're getting from the continuous echo from the CW. That would be very little time domain interference. The IF strip would only be some number of kilohertz wide and only see signals with that separation. So only your own signal going out, reflecting, coming back has the right signature, the right separation in frequency, so that the IF strip would respond to it. Do you see what I'm saying on that one, Steve? Mr. HUC, K2RIW?
Nope, I gotcha. So the chances of them modulating any type of information is unlikely, is what you're saying. Fair enough. KD2HUC, back to net.
As I see it, it's not required. The radars will have very little effect on each other, and I don't think there's any reason to put an identifying signal on the radar. The automobile has got a license plate. You could, if you want to, with your light-emitting diodes that are used for the headlights and the taillights, you could modulate them in various ways that the eye wouldn't see it, but that they could be transmitting signals. So there's various ways the automobiles can talk to each other, but I don't think they have to do it from the radar. And you'd like to keep the radar nice and simple and inexpensive. So those are a bunch of guesses on my part, Joe. But we'd have to dig a little bit deeper. There must be a website somewhere that'll tell us how a collision avoidance radar works. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. That's a homework assignment, Joe. How does a collision avoidance radar work? You got it, Joe.
Okay, very good, Dick. Thanks for entertaining the question. I know you had one other guy after me. If you have time before 9 o'clock, I do have another question I could add, not related to this, just something else kind of goofy that I just discovered a couple of days ago, making a measurement off the air. But if you don't have time, I'll table it next week.
Since we've only got two chickens so far tonight, there's a high probability we'll have some more time. Okay, next person who signed in was Chester. Hey, Chet. WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilowatt, K2RIW. You got it, Chet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. First I want to check, is my signal okay? Are you hearing me okay? Over.
I'm hearing you okay. Over. Go right ahead, Chet.
Yeah, I don't have the crackles tonight. It's been on the repeater for the last month or so. All right. This is just a comment. It's about HF and my activities. And what I found, and your usual earnest saying about if you resonate an antenna, it will radiate. All right. The last couple of days, during the day, on 20 meters, I worked three stations. Only reason why I worked three stations, because I didn't want to stick around anymore. It was just like, call CQ. And yesterday I worked two people without trying hard, you know. And today I worked another station. Let it drop for a second. Okay. Yesterday I worked a Mobile station in Ohio, which is short skip. And we had a nice conversation, let's say about 15, 20 minutes. He was mobiling on an expressway in Ohio. And nice conversation. And then I asked him what he was running. And he was running 100 watts, 100 watt station. And he told me his antenna was a screwdriver antenna on the center of his roof. And I asked him about the antenna. Well, he told me it was a screwdriver. And he said, you won't believe it, but my antenna is only 30 inches high. 30 inches. But he had a screwdriver antenna, and apparently he was able to resonate it. He had a great signal. He carried on a long conversation. And we had a drop. And today, besides working a guy in Florida at the beach, and he had an end-fed antenna, the pole that held up his antenna, his end-fed antenna, was a fishing rod. And we had a half-hour conversation with him on the beach, and he was also running 100 watts, and it was great, great conversation. There was QS Baker, just a little bit, 90% of the time. Both of those two stations were well above the noise and armchair copy. Today, I worked the Mobile station in Indiana, and we also had a long conversation. And he got around and told me about his antenna, and he says, you won't believe it, but my antenna is a screwdriver antenna, and it's mounted on top of the roof with a magnetic whip, and it's only 24 inches high. So what my comment is that what you were saying is, your signal does not depend on how long your antenna is, as long as you resonate it. That's exactly like you said. These guys are coming in beautiful. So I just wanted to report working those stations. Go ahead.
You had a very slight misquote, though, Chet, of what I say. My exact way of saying it is that if you're designing an antenna and you want it to work well, resonate first, then it will radiate. That's a so-called standing wave antenna. 99% of the antennas we use are so-called standing wave antenna. That means the signal's reflecting back and forth in the antenna radiating structure, which really consists of the antenna, maybe some of its feed line, maybe an antenna tuner, a matchbox, and maybe the final stage of the transmitter itself. That radiating system must resonate on a so-called standing wave antenna. The only non-standing wave antennas are things like a rhombic and a beverage, things that are multiple wavelengths long with a terminating resistor on the end. That's a traveling wave antenna. The signal is down there once. But in the case of our antenna, the signal is going to be bouncing back and forth in the radiating structure, all of those components that I mentioned. And you'd like all of those bounces to stay in phase, to stay correlated. And when you do, you build up a nice high current or a nice high voltage. Actually, if the antenna is small compared to a wavelength, and these are 36, 39-inch antennas you're talking about, and 24-inch antennas. You didn't say, but I'm going to guess it was 20 meters. Even though the antenna itself is so short in wavelength, let me drop. An antenna is very short in wavelength, being fed at the end, gives you a highly capacitive reactance, maybe 2,000 ohms of capacitive reactance. But if you've got 2,000 ohms of inductive reactance coming out of the antenna tuner, you can force that into resonance. So once the antenna resonates, a high percentage of the power you put into it will be radiated. And the only way you get more gain out of an antenna is to have multiple wavelengths. You've got to have more real estate so that you can develop an antenna pattern. When the antenna is short in wavelength, it is It's got a very omnidirectional pattern, almost radiating in all directions in space at once. So therefore, and you would think that the effective capture area is going to be very small because the antenna is small. Well, the magic of resonance, of high Q resonance, is that because the antenna resonates, you've got to think about the antenna in the transmitting sense. Let me drop. Because almost all the antennas we build obey the law of reciprocity. Whatever properties they've got on reception, they've got the exact same properties on transmission. Well, in the case of an antenna that is too short, but you force it into resonance, and if it's made out of low loss materials, there's not a lot of resistance in it, you can easily make an antenna where you put 50 watts into it, and 48 watts gets radiated. It can run, 90-some-odd% efficiency on transmission. Therefore, it's going to have the exact same efficiency on reception. It's going to have a great big capture area, even though your eye doesn't see it. That 24-inch whip, that 39-inch whip, might have a capture area of quite a few square feet on 20 meters once it's resonated. The magic of resonance does all that. The biggest example I can give of is an 80-meter dipole. A full-size 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, made out of 14-gauge wire. It casts a shadow on the ground of less than 1 square foot. But the radio area of that antenna is 8,500 square feet. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you look at that antenna broadside, you see a great big black oval in space with a wire in the middle of it, the wire of the dipole, 8,500 square feet. That's the real radio capture area of a full-size dipole. And when you make that dipole infinitesimally small, a small fraction of a wavelength, but re-resonated, you still get 80-some-odd percent of the original capture area and the original performance. It becomes very high in Q. Your QSY, a couple of KC, and you got to redo it. But so was it 20 meters, and obviously they were resonating it with a good antenna tuner of some kind. I guess with the screwdriver structure, you've got a built-in antenna tuner, so to speak. Over you, Chet. WB2AHK, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's the band I like to operate. I also operate on 40. But I got more noise on my antenna on 40 meters. My radiator has noise, QR Nancy. So 20 meters is a different antenna, and stable to noise ratio is much superior at my antenna farm. Yeah, it was 20 meters. The fellow on 20 meters today said he had some experiments done in his mobile station. He says he's using a magnetic mount antenna, and he says he knows the efficiency of the magnet connecting to the roof, the metal roof, is less than optimum, but he didn't want to drill any holes in his car. But he thinks that would improve his signal somewhat if he actually made an actual antenna installation without the magnetic mounting. But he also mentioned one thing. I wonder what you think about this. He said he did some experiment with a longer antenna, like the CB type length whips. He didn't give me any numbers on it, but something like 108-inch whip or something like that. And he says he gets less results, optimum results, with the longer antenna, because he says the longer antenna connects to the ground more, under the car. And he says there's ground losses with the longer antenna. And he says he gets superior results using the car's roof and extremely smaller, shorter antenna is superior in signal. He gets better results with the shorter antenna, thus using the rooftop. What do you think about the ground losses with a longer whip antenna on the back of the car? Over.
I'm a little bit doubtful on that one, Chet. By the way, a mag mount is capable of giving you full performance. Common sense would lead you to believe you could drill a hole in the roof of the car and really ground the bottom of the antenna and make good contact with the sheet metal. It's going to work better. Not necessarily. Between that mag mount and that thin little sheet of plastic between it and the metal of the car is a series capacitor. So that series capacitor is part of the antenna. And if you could suddenly pierce that piece of plastic and make a perfect contact to the sheet metal, it would change the tuning of the antenna, because that series capacitor is now gone, that means you have to readjust your antenna tuner. But once you readjust the antenna tuner, you're right back at the same spot. That capacitor between the bottom of your mag mount and the roof of the antenna is not a lossy capacitor. I mean, unless you've got carbon granules in there instead of a sheet of plastic, that's a high Q capacitor, low loss. You could prove it by putting 50 watts into the antenna for 5 minutes and turn everything off and go over there and see if the piece of plastic is hot. And I think it will be. It's being cooled by the sheet metal. And so that series capacitor is perfectly legitimate to be that as a ground plane, part of the ground plane antenna, just a part of the tuning that you do with the antenna tuner. With his longer piece of wire, let me drop it. For all we know, the particular piece of transmission line between that piece of wire and his antenna tuner, which maybe it was located in the output stage of the transmitter, that particular length of transmission line could have been lossier with the particular tuning required for the longer wire. The longer wire antenna has less capacitive reactance. It's a different impedance on the end of the cable. So coupling to the ground, I doubt it. I don't think the amount of coupling to the ground is substantially different for the short versus the long antenna. I think there's something else going on with the loss of the feed line and the loss of the antenna tuner, and how well the antenna tuner is tuned. There are various ways you can set up an antenna tuner. Some of them have more loss. I mean, you could have the antenna tuner set up as a pie match, and you could have more inductance and less capacitance on both ends. I mean, there's a couple of different settings of the inductor where you can still force it into resonance and good impedance match by setting the C1 and C2 capacitors of your Pi network. And some of those methods of setting the antenna tuner are lossier than others. They create greater circulating current inside of the antenna tuner. Let me drop this. And one of the things I wish antenna tuner manufacturers would do is give you a series of Smith charts, where portions of the Smith chart are colored in, telling you that those are the impedances that this antenna tuner works well on. And some of those places are going to be a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio, just for a short little section of the Smith chart. But I wish a manufacturer would give you that kind of information so you know what you're getting ahead of time. And that would give you some hints as to what kind of antennas with what kind of feed lines. Because all you've got to do is add a little bit more transmission lines to a mismatched antenna, and the impedance you see at the input end changes considerably. The transmission line makes you walk around the Smith chart, so to speak. Longer transmission line, you walk more clockwise around the Smith chart, and your dot of impedance comes out into a different spot. And so there are times when your antenna tuner doesn't make it, and you change the length of the transmission line and try again, and the antenna tuner will now make it on the exact same antenna with low-loss transmission line. I know this is more than you asked for, but over to you, Chet. Could be B2AHK, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Very informative. Very informative. So, especially about the magnetic magnet at the base of the antenna. And it's not just to try to duplicate a ground, which doesn't exist because it has a piece of plastic there. It's a capacitor. I didn't realize that. Actually, I didn't really think deep enough, I guess, about that. And you're right. It's actually part of the antenna system and part of the loading of the inductance and capacitance. So there you go. You just taught me something. That's quite interesting. But final thing I would say is that while there's no sunspot cycle of any consequence and the bands are not crowded, If you go at the right time, you can't go on 20 meters right now. There's no signal. It's dead. You can go on 40, there's signal. But you have to go at the right time in order to make contacts. You can't go at 9 o'clock at night and say, well, the band is dead, because the band is dead. There's nobody on. But if you go in the daytime on 20 meters, which is the optimum time, you will make contacts, whether the sunspot cycle is good and you know the sunspots or not. So that's something I want to, in case anybody's listening, the bands are not dead. They're up. If you call CQ, give it a try.
some will find you, and you'll have fun. So get out there and get on the air. K2RIW72AHK.
Because you've got a lot more experience on 20 meters, which I don't use, on the average day, what time in the morning does 20 meters open up? What time at night does it close down during a low sunspot cycle like we've got right now? And you're saying during the day, when the sun is shining and ionizing that E layer, F layer, whatever, you're saying there are good signals in there. I presume they're not super strong. So what time of day and what kind of ranges are you getting on 20 meters during the day? And does it really close down at night? Over to you, Chet, K2LIW.
Apparently, it does. It does close down at night. Activity picks up, according to the gray line. Most people know about the gray line. And you'll start picking up signals after daylight on 20 meters. And things start to close down an hour or two after sunset. The optimum time, I'm thinking, I'm not an expert, but I get on and I listen. I listen 95% of the time and only transmit 5% of the time. Because I'm looking for DX and stuff like that. But right now you can pick up good signals for sure, between 12 noon and 5 o'clock. That would, to me, would be an optimum time to get on 20 meters and make plenty of contacts. And let's see. As you mentioned, the signal noise ratio is the important thing. It's not if a guy's coming in 40 over 9, if the sunspot cycles were a high number of sunspot cycles, when you let it drop the thing. If the sunspots were high, number of sunspots, a signal that's coming in S6 now would be coming in, let's say, well, that's, you know, chagrin to say that you would get a signal 30 over 9, 20 over 9. And now those same signals with no sunspots, they're coming in S6. However, the most important thing to me is not how strong the signal is, it's the signal-to-noise ratio. So let's say you have an antenna on 20 meters that has an S1, which I have, signal-to-noise ratio, QR Nancy level, the bottom line there. When you turn the radio on, there's no signal to listen to, and you have whatever your S meter reads. In my case, it's like S1, S2. As the guy's coming in S6, gee, that's 24 dBs is more signal-to-noise ratio. And all you need is signal-to-noise ratio. That's the most important thing. You can have a great contact. All you need is a good reception. And you don't have to be S9 and 20 over 9, 30 over 9 to have a good chance of having a good conversation. S6 is fine, S7. That's the majority of signals. We're coming in S6, S7. Occasionally you get S9 signals. Go ahead.
Okay, so 20 meters opens up during the daytime when the sun is shining on you and the guy you're talking to. So when it comes to domestic QSOs, talking to other people in the United States, you start off at noontime and the guy in California has got 9 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, he's got some sunlight, so you can talk to him. I am guessing that when the sunspot cycle is high, choosing the right time of day and talking to Japan is relatively easy. But with low sunspot cycle and only daytime propagation, my guess is you wouldn't be able to have a real long haul over to Japan on one of these QSOs. Is that true, Chet? Over to you, Chet, K2RIW.
Well, yeah, I would say that's 100% true. Hearing signals from Europe during the day is usually easy enough to hear stations coming in from Europe. There's a lot of stations during the day. But I restrict myself to continental stations, working Florida, South Carolina, Midwest, and sometimes out to California. I have worked California in the last week or two. But I restrict myself to short skip and medium skip, and that satisfies me. Of course, I don't have much of an antenna. It also has to do with what kind of antenna, how much power you're running. I'm running 100 watts and a dipole at 30 feet. Now, if I had a four-element beam and I'm running 1,500 watts PEP, I'd be putting out one heck of a signal. And I'd also, if I had a good Yagi beam, I'd be picking up those stations another S-unit stronger. So it also depends on what kind of station you have. But 100 watts and a dipole antenna gets you a short skip and medium skip. Go ahead.
Your dipole that you're using, is it approximately 32 feet long, a full half-wave dipole? And at what altitude at your house, Chet? Go ahead.
Yeah, what I'm doing, because I want to keep the neighbors from being unhappy, I have an amplifier, but I don't have it in line. I run 100 watts, nobody's ringing my doorbells. My antenna is only 30 feet up, 30 foot up on a metal pole, and I'm using the driven element only. I had a three-element Cushcraft beam, and I discarded everything but the driven element. It's a tri-band aluminum dipole, and it's less than 32 feet long because it has the traps. I'm thinking like only like 25 feet, something like that. Don't know exactly, don't remember, but it's the driven element of a trap dipole. Go ahead.
So that used to be a Yagi. Is that rotatable in your case, Chet? Go ahead.
It was, but I sold all my rotators. I find that if I turn the beam, transmitting beam, towards Europe, which I like to work DX across the pond. In other words, I orientate the antenna northeast, and then it would be southwest. And, you know, a dipole has a clover leaf pattern, and I get Midwest, I get to work Cajun California, I easily reach Florida, and I get the Midwest really well. So a dipole really doesn't have to be, if you orientate it where you really would like to go, you don't have to worry too much about rotating the antenna. So in my case, I orientated it to where I would pick up in a good manner the area where I would like to be heard. Go ahead.
Yeah, because Europe to you is to the northeast, I think you set up your dipole so that the broadside of the dipole faces northeast and southwest. Is that true, Richard?
Yeah, and because it's neighbor friendly, I don't have a big array up, and I'm only running 100 watts, and I do really good on the band. I really do. Sometimes the band, you know, there is sunspot cycles, and sometimes signals are coming in like gangbusters from all over the place. And contest day, oh my gosh, the bands are dead, you think, and then you try to find a clear frequency on 20 meters when the contest is on, and it's almost impossible. There are plenty of stations on. So, make a long story short, I keep my station neighbor-friendly. I had bigger antennas up, I had massive stuff up, and, you know, I did the power stuff. And my wife put the kibosh on that pretty quickly when the doorbell started ringing. So I've been keeping a low profile, and nobody bothers me here, and I don't bother anybody. So that's the way I like it. Go ahead.
Are most of these QSOs sideband or also CW? Are you a Morse code enthusiast or mostly a sideband enthusiast, Chet? Go ahead.
When I get bored only, I tune to a CW, the bottom end of the band, and I keep up with trying to get it with a piece of paper, and I keep myself, my prowess up by listening and writing things down. It's fun. That's why there's a lot of people on CW, because it's like video games for the young kids. They love the video games, and there are many hams who like to, the fun of operating CW. No, I don't operate CW as a sideband, but I do go down that way, and I enjoy trying to copy and see if I still remember everything. And it's kind of like bicycle riding. Once you learn CW, the only thing changes is the amount of speed of reception or transmission that you have without practicing. But you never forget. Once you have been on CW and operating CW for a year or two, it's like bicycle riding. You it's like you just can't forget it. It's always you're always there. You might be able to if you spent more time at it to increase your prowess and expertise at listening and transmitting. But I don't actually operate CW. The reason for that is I operate in remote base, and I'm actually in my house and I'm transmitting to my yard, to my garage with a remote base. And so I can't operate CW the way I have my station set up, because I didn't want any wires coming from my antenna area coming back to the house, hanging up in the air. All the wires go to the garage, and then I radio over from where I am in the house back to the garage. Go ahead.
WS2N.
Okay, a little bit noisy, but go ahead, Paul. Very noisy, in fact. WS2N, KQRIW. Because right now you're 80% noise, 20% audio. With earphones, I can copy you with some difficulty, but I guarantee some of the people listening are not going to hear you, Paul. Your antenna is either not pointed toward Glen Oaks, or you're about to go to Sheldon, I guess it is. WS2N, KQRIW.
Let me see. I didn't move the antenna yet, but how's this thing?
Huge improvement. What did you do? You sound beautiful.
I just went through the Ethernet input. I didn't even get a chance to turn my antenna yet. I just switched the frequency, so it'll be better yet when I turn the antenna. So, okay, yeah. I don't know if Chet heard me, but yeah, last weekend, not today, or, I'm talking about last weekend, they had the CW sweepstakes, and from, I'd say, midday all the way till late at night, on both days, they had the CW sweepstakes, and then there wasn't an open spot to have a QSO on CW. It was incredible. I'm just wondering if you listened to that, like I did. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead for that answer, Chet.
Yeah, that might be when I was listening recently, because there were so many signals. It's like magic, Dick. You get so many people who don't give it a try and say, oh, the bands are dead. You got to be there at the right time, when the signals are supposed to come in. It's like, nature. Nature says 20 meters is good after sunrise to sundown right now. When the sunspots are good, it's like all night, all day. But that's going to be 7 years from now. When there's a contest, sideband or CW, you try to find a clear frequency to let me know. That'll be like winning the lottery. Go ahead.
Sounds to me, Chet, like you're having a lot of time, a lot of fun, with 20 meters during the daytime with a poor sunspot cycle. During the real good sunspot cycle, you'd have a lot longer range capability, but the bands, I'm sure, would be a lot more crowded, and therefore it's like being on the Long Island Expressway during rush hour. Sounds to me like you're actually having more fun with low sunspot cycle than you would with high. Give me V2AHK, K2RIW.
And here's the reason. You hit the nail on the head. You hit a lot of nails on the head, Dick. You're quite the guy. Very knowledgeable about things. Here's why I like it now, rather than when the sunspot cycle is back again. I'm running 100 watts with a dipole, and everything is hunky-dory because there's plenty of frequencies, there's less crowding. You can find a spot, a clear spot, easily during the day, and call CQ. I didn't have any trouble. I called CQ twice today, and I got a couple of stations, one after the other, and yesterday the same thing. I don't get on the air all that often. I'm too busy doing a million other things, and I rather build things. I'm working on my model railroad. That's my new phase right now. I'm in the basement doing things. But ham radio, I always come on, you know, at least once a day, twice a day, call TQ. But when it's like now, conditions now, I can find a frequency, I can call TQ, and they're going to hear my 100-watt signal with a dipole of 30 feet and have a long conversation. But when conditions are good, sunspot cycle is back again, then I have to compete with the guys with the stacked beams at 1,500 watts or whatever. The big guns come on because they're so excited. Oh, the bands are back. And they don't even hear me because I can't compete because of the my power and the antennas. K2RIW, WB2AHK.
Okay, 20 meters behaves this way. I'm guessing during the daytime, 40 meters has a fair amount of D-level absorption, D-layer absorption. 80, of course, does. I'm sure 80 is dead during the day. 40 probably is not so good. 20 sounds to me like you're having a grand old time. What is 15 meters and 10 meters like during the daytime, Chet? WB2AHK, K2RIW.
I'm ashamed to say I haven't even tried it. 15 and 10. I know a little bit. I know that if conditions are because of the sunspot cycles are poor, 10 meters, forget about it. Really, honestly, for another 5 or 6 years, I wouldn't try it. And 15 meters, I have occasionally called CQ, but the band is totally dead during the daytime. I haven't spent much time there, but I just realized that it's not going to be a good band. You have to pick the band that's going to work. And to me, you really want to work with stations, you know, into the, you know, medium and short skip, and into Europe, where I hear VKs and stuff in early morning on 20 meters. You tune, listen, around 6 o'clock in the morning, you're going to hear VKs and things. Long skip does come in right around the gray line. But they're not going to hear me. I'm going to make 100-watt signal. So you have to know what kind of signal you're going to put out and when to operate, and you have good luck. So just a little bit of knowledge, and you can have fun on 20 meters, and that's what I've been doing. However, 40 meters is actually open all day long, but the noise floor gets worse. It has been pretty bad around here, atmospheric. And I have to pick my time when early morning, around 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock, it's quiet. I can make plenty of contacts on 40 meters without having the noise. But I turn it off when the noise level gets too high, and that's later on in the day. Go ahead.
What do you use for a 40-meter antenna, Chet?
I took ladder line, window line, I should say, window line. I made an antenna out of window line, half-wave folded dipole on 40 meters using window line. And I also used the same window line to come down to a balance and change the balanced into unbalanced at the base of my pole. And I run coax through the window of the garage to my station. So it's up about 30 feet as well. And it's very broadbanded. Once I set the tuner on 40 meters, and for 20, by the way, but we're talking about 40 with the window line, I can do a whole band, a phone band, on 40 meters without having to retune. Doesn't make much difference. Go ahead.
Is your 40 meter folded dipole about 60 feet tip to tip?
It is. It's 60. It is 60, I think it's 66 foot. And because I don't have that much length, I have two poles in my backyard, and then I go to the chimney with the main pole, which is 30 feet high in the middle. I run one half of the 40 meter antenna towards the chimney. It's like about almost a 90 degree angle, almost, but not quite. And then the other half of the dipole, folded dipole, goes to the a pole on the other end of my yard. So it's not stretched out straight because of my property boundary. So, but it works great. Go ahead.
So with the sun shining on the ionosphere, you're getting enough ionization to get some good signals on 40 and 20 meters. To get a reflection at a higher frequency, 15 and 10 meters, you need a greater degree of ionization. and with a low sunspot cycle, you're not getting that. I think that could be the reason why 15 meters and 10 meters during the daytime at this time is closed. Does that sound reasonable, Chet? Over to you, K2LIW.
I would agree 100% or 90%. I think there's a chance at certain points of the day that you can work 15 meters and get, you might be surprised who you get. Who knows? You might get a VK here and there. But the band is like a, it's like totally empty. And of course, 10 meters as well. 10 meters is good for local contacts. You know, if you set up a you know, a bunch of fellas in your neighborhood or 5 miles away, you can set up a nice little round table on 10 meters, nice and quiet for you. Nobody bothers you. But unfortunately, 15 meters is wasted right now. But 20 meters is doing really well, as long as you operate during the daytime. Go ahead.
Good to know. I haven't used HF in a long time. I'm a VHFer, UHFer. So I'm learning a lot. I thank you. Good information. Alrighty, let's see what Joe's next question is. WB2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, I tried transmitting on west and went back to east. Okay, you'll probably hear me okay. This question is something I think I brought up in the past. It's about a broadcast. Transmits on 540 kilohertz. And I happened to discover actually by accident like about a year or two ago that the thing is actually transmitting elsewhere in the broadcast band. I can pick it up on not only 1080, which is two times the frequency, but I can also pick it up on 1620, which is three times the frequency. On 1080, I can hear it about 7-8 miles away, primarily going in like a northwest direction of this station. Here's what I discovered that's kind of unusual. I don't know what the power levels drop to, but when it goes to nighttime operation, the interference goes away to the point we have to drive almost on top of the station within the 8th of a mile, 1620. I don't know what the